Major Cochrane, Reel 4. Now, we were talking about your time at Wadham College in 1938 through to 39, and we just got on to the lectures, and you were discussing, you said they weren't compulsory, but there were about three a day.
Yes, which you could have gone to, because law was broken into, like any subject. There were, you know, there was criminal law, civil law, international. I don't think we got as far as international law in the first year, but constitutional law. And sometimes there wouldn't have been three a day, there would have been two. But usually one got lectures, were in the morning. Probably the first lecture was about nine, something like that. And there'd be at least two in the morning. There might have been one either in the afternoon or in the evening. Not in the afternoon, certainly in the first year. They weren't compulsory. You were strongly advised by your tutor, you know, don't miss so-and-so's lectures on criminal law. You may find that so-and-so on constitutional law is a bit dry, but the books are as follows. And there was one chap who, I mean, none of us could hear him. I mean, so it was a waste of time ever going.
He mumbled.
Yes. And Sir Faulkner spoke with his chin on his chest. And so in that case, one said this was a waste of time, and one's tutor said, well, I can understand that. Then the books you should be reading are thus and thus and thus. In addition to books to amplify the lectures, there were other books that your tutor set you to read. Useful having Latin, because first year law, you do quite a bit of Roman law. And Latin was a help there.
Would you buy the books, or would you get them from the library, or was it a combination?
You had to provide them yourself. And if it was a subject that was being taught all over the university, no library really could help. On the other hand, everybody, when they'd finished their year, or certainly when they'd finished, they sold the books back to Blackwell. And Blackwell's second-hand department, you could really buy pretty cheap almost anything you wanted. I made an awful gaffe having done this, having bought. You were told what essentials you had to have and what were useful things to have in addition. And I got all the certainly essential ones at Blackwell. And then made the fearful social gaffe of trying to pay for them. And I was told in no uncertain terms, oh, no, sir, no, that's not how. You'll get a bill in due course. things have changed a bit since then, I think, even probably at Blackwell. But you did have to buy the books. In some cases, one kept them for interest, or because, I suppose, if one was thinking of actually really becoming a lawyer, it might even have been useful. But in most cases, having used them, you then sold them back again to, and Blackwell were pretty good at giving you a fair price.
Would the library, I mean, how did the library come in? In your first couple of years, first year, would you need the library much, or were you basically working off textbooks?
Really off textbooks. The college, I suppose college libraries vary. The Bodleian, of course, for an undergraduate or first year undergraduate, I mean, you peered in at the Bodleian with great respect. But you weren't qualified to get a reader's ticket at the Bodleian. College library varied, you know, how good it was on different subjects. But elementary textbooks, rightly, I think, they didn't stock. You were supposed to make your own way there.
And that was what you really were interested in. You didn't need anything much beyond the elementary.
No.
How did you take to law?
I find it I find it interesting, actually. In a curiously artificial way, it seemed that these were sort of curiously arbitrary rules. Criminal law was fairly straightforward. I mean, one could see that various things were not on, shouldn't be done, and so on. But it did seem to me, in a way, that the rules governing civil law and constitutional law were rather arbitrary, and yes, one could learn them, but they didn't seem to me to be essential to existence. Well, that was a very young man's view, but the mere fact that I felt I didn't dislike doing law at all, and indeed even the things that I found rather offbeat were still in themselves of interest, rather like doing crossword puzzles. But perhaps that's one of the reasons why, without later on, towards the end of the war, I gave up the idea of the law without any great pangs or regrets.
Now, how much of your time did it take as a first year, studying, or was there plenty of time for socialising, your rowing club, your other things? We'll come to them, but I mean, was it onerous, your studying, or?
No, I think I did enough work. I mean, I got through at the end of the year. You had to do a preliminary exam, which was called law moderations, and I got through that all right. So I did enough work to get by, and I don't think I was ever told by my tutor that I was lazy or idle. On the other hand, I didn't have plenty of time to have, well, every afternoon, winter and summer, I used to go down to the river.
Now, this is your rowing?
Rowing.
Was that your big activity? I mean.
Well, it was certainly my only sport.
What interested you? We'll look at rowing. We'll come to the other, perhaps, amusements later. But what interested you about rowing? Why rowing? Because you hadn't done it before, had you?
Even as a small boy, I'd messed about with a rowing boat. I could row a rowing boat. My mother had been brought up. Her father had kept a yacht on the Clyde. It sounds rather grandiose. It was a sailing boat, anyhow. And she was very good in a rowing boat. And so this possibly was a lead-in. I've been accustomed, actually, to pulling an oar of a sort in water. And I went down to try it out after I was asked if I'd like to join the boat club. And I did enjoy it. With a long oar, and I found it agreeable to be with other people in the boat. And it is rather exhilarating to go along at a fair clip. And also, I made a rather joke about the fact that it was a great pleasure after years of playing rugby to find you could get your fresh air and healthy exercise while sitting down, unlike most other sports. The other one, well, I used to go to the.
What was the training? Sorry, sticking. What was the training regime like?
Pretty stiff. I mean, you began as a novice. I never got into a boat to start with. There's what's called tubbing, and a tub was like a piece of a boat but fixed. I mean, it was stationary, and the oar, like a colander, had a lot of holes punched in it, so you could, in fact, pull it through the water without upsetting this stationary tub that you were seated in. And you were taught there how to use your legs, use your arms, use the seat, which was on rollers going to and fro, and get your movement synchronized. And then after that, you were put in actually in a boat with seven other people plus a featherweight to do the steering for you. And you rowed and rowed and rowed. And this, you different sorts of training. You did long stretches, keeping a steady pace for a long distance. You did short burst training, accelerating from zero to as fast as you could. You did train, particularly the coach was particularly glad when you had some bad weather, a strong wind, so you were rowing in waves. Not that, of course, the ISIS ever had waves like the Thames has, but still, you could be in a boat that was rocking to and fro. And once they thought that you could, in fact, be given a place in a crew, whether it was the first crew or the second crew, you then practiced with that crew, and occasionally they decided that you might be better move one seat up or one seat down in the order, a lot depended on your weight, to get the balance right in the boat. And it sounds rather boring and tedious, and I suppose in a way it was, but I enjoyed it very much.
Did it build you up?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, were you put on a special diet, or I mean, were you?
No, nothing like that.
It wasn't sorted out like that then.
Yeah. No, I think. I think if perhaps if one had been rowing really seriously for the university, of course, to do that, you'd probably have been rowing at school for several years. One of the schools that is on a river and does teach rowing. And I don't think anybody could get as far as that class if within one or two years they ever started.
Now, you've got on your wall, I can see it from here, your Oxford University Boat Club 8, 1939. You were in the first crew of Wadham College Boat Club.
Yeah.
And it's got five bumps, and then bumped the names of the colleges you bumped. I presume, would that mean the races you'd won? Or
yes.
What?
No, of course, the ice is a very narrow river, so you can't race side by side. So you have to chase the boat in front while the boat behind is chasing you. And you don't, it's called bumps. But in fact, actually, if your bow gets past the stern of the boat in front, that counts as a bump. You actually haven't got to ram the boat. Well, they're too expensive to risk that.
So just two of you go at once, or is
no,
it a chain?
No, a whole string of them. And of course, what gets very complicated is if when you bump the boat in front, both crews, the one, the boat that has been bumped and the boat that's done the bumping, pull into the edge as quick as possible, because there's then a gap where two boats used to be between the boat in front. And occasionally it happens that a boat will then still overtake the boat that began, one, two, three boats ahead of it, called an overbump. And so that's like sort of playing snakes and ladders. You really shoot up the ladder if you can do that.
But you don't appear to have done that, are
you? No. So there are six races, and we bumped the crew in front out of five of the races.
And once you'd be bumped, I presume.
No. That's called rowing over, when the boat in front and the boat behind, nobody catches anybody.
Yeah. Would people watch this?
Oh, yes, everybody turned out to watch the actual racing. But, of course, the practicing, nobody. The coach, I've forgotten who it was who coached us. I think it was a senior oarsman from the college, from the university. Anyhow, he'd ride up and down the towpath on a bicycle with a megaphone, shouting your number five, you're pulling, doing something wrong. It was good cohesive training, of course.
And when would the race be?
You have races called the Torpids, of all names, I suppose because it's a sort of sluggish time of year, in the spring. And then 8th week is in the summer, in the summer term, June.
Now, what about your other activities? Were you in it? What other societies?
I was in the Dramatic Society.
And what?
And I think I was in the Debating Society. Which one? I mean.
What did you do with the Dramatic Society?
Well, we put on. Wadham has a lovely garden, a great big garden, and the society nearly always didn't do much in midwinter, but in the spring and in the beginning of the summer term, it rehearsed hard at a play to be done, and this was always done in the college garden grounds. And the only one I remember is acting in a play by a Czech writer called Karl Čapek, called The Insect Play. And I vividly remember my role, which was that of a dung beetle, which I felt I played with great feeling and depth of understanding.
And that was just the Wadham College Society.
Yeah.
Not they weren't overreaching over the whole of Oxford.
No, if you were any good, you were urged to join either. You go into the OUDS, the Oxford University Dramatic Society, and that had an offshoot, which did. Rather like the Cambridge Footlights, which did kind of review sketches and so on. No, this was just at college level.
And what about the Debating Society? Was that college or?
No, I never. I used to attend the Oxford Union debates. These were sort of big set piece occasions. But we used to debate against other colleges, and then there was you had four speakers, two on either side, and. Generally speaking, the agreement went on which had been the most, which speakers had been more amusing rather than which had been more philosophically true to whatever the subject was.
Now, what about your political perspectives and your awareness of whether what was going on in Nazi Germany, firstly, and secondly, the approach of war? How was that going? You were still only young, you were about 18, 19, you know.
Well, I knew, I think most of us did, certainly I did because of family, all about the persecution of the Jews, because my mother, her closest and dearest friend since they were at school together, had been, she was a Jewish girl, and my mother had lived in and out of the two girls that lived in and out of each other's families almost interchangeably. So therefore, not the really holy festivals, but my mother had been looked on as somebody in the family attending the minor festivals, Jewish festivals. And in fact, my sister and I were brought up, we played as much with those Jewish families, large families, lots of cousins and second cousins, and they all had children, as we did with any other children. There were Jewish families in Glasgow. So through them, there was no doubt about what was going on in Germany. My parents also had been bitterly upset by Japanese invasion of China for all the reasons of having been so long in China. They were horrified about Mussolini in Ethiopia, incensed at the inability of the United Nations to do anything.
How did you share their views, or
well,
were you just more just aware of them?
I was aware of them, I don't think I was. I accepted them as being the case, and I can never remember arguing the case about Hitler or Mussolini with anybody. I mean, I just assumed my parents were right, and this was evil. And
did you see that a war was coming?
Oh, at Oxford, yes, absolutely no doubt whatsoever. I mean, I think we all knew that, especially after, I don't think anybody thought that Munich solved anything. I mean, my parents were convinced that this was the biggest sellout imaginable. Mind you, I think if we'd gone to war at the time of Munich, it would have been probably disastrous. But I don't think we had any, no surprise at all when September 39 came along.
What about the politically? I mean, did you have any political interests at your time, either
pro
or anti anything?
No, the only political interest I had was that the people at Oxford, who were as bitter about Munich as my parents were also the same people who were fighting tooth and nail against the thought of conscription. And this seemed to me to be so totally and wholly illogical that I did join a kind of, I think it was a, it was certainly there was a strong push to have a debate at the Union in which, I don't think there was anything this House welcomes conscription, but this House accepts that conscription is a political necessity as well as a military one, something like that. Was the wording. And I do know that the only activity I think politically, if you like, I was involved in at Oxford was rallying support to come to the Union and vote in favour of this motion.
Which is a reversal of the famous one. I'm not quite sure what it was, but
that was in 1933, I think.
Quite a bit before. Attitude was changing, was it? Did you come against a lot of antagonism when you pushed this pro-conscription viewpoint?
Not really, because I think it was pretty easy to say, particularly to people one knew, because they'd tried to propagandise one about the iniquities of Chamberlain and the Sudeten German winning. The fact that the chicken out. And you were like me, dead against Chamberlain and the Munich settlement. How can you possibly, in view of the present situation, be against conscription? Unarguable. They could shut the door on your face, but they couldn't argue against it.
Now, another question that could be put was, why didn't you join the OTC or the territorials in the area? Was that not possible, given your...
No, I think it might have been possible. I mean, a very old friend, I mean, a friend I'd made during the war, I've been a friend ever since, he was a Cambridge man, but he had, I think he'd gone up to Cambridge the same time as I'd done, to Oxford. But he had joined the Cambridge University Air Squadron. I don't know, I never thought of joining the OTC at Oxford. Partly, I think perhaps because I knew it was coming anyhow, and partly maybe I then thought, well, I've got the wretched A certificate, or certificate A from the school OTC. That'll do me. But when the time came, I had no hesitation in joining up.
Now, what about the actual declaration of war? That would be in your vacation, I presume, summer vacation.
Yes, that was in September. We were having a family holiday, my parents, my sister and I, in the island of Arran, off the west coast of Scotland. And we were there when war was... No, actually, we were there when war was brewing up, and we left Arran and had got to my father's sister's, my aunt's house in Prestwick, and it was there that we heard Chamberlain announcing that we were in a state of war with Germany.
You actually heard it?
Yes.
How did you feel?
Well, it's happened, it was bound to happen, it's going to happen. But the days beforehand, it was perfectly evident that it was going to happen. So it was really no element of surprise about it.
So what did you do?
Well, I first of all said, I'm going to join up, and I might as well do it now. And my father said, I think before you join up, yes, I can see why you want to join up, and I think you're right. But before joining up, I think you should go back and tidy up your affairs at Oxford. You've still got your books and stuff that you've left behind there. And I think I probably left a trunk of clothes off there as well. And he said, I have a word with them about are they making any arrangements at Oxford for people joining up, which was good advice. So I went back to Oxford, did pack up my stuff, and said goodbye to the warden, who, marvellous man, Maurice Barrer, who had come up as a newcomer to Oxford just after the First World War, in which he'd been a gunner, a very young gunner. And his parting words to me, which I've quoted since in that book, were, he said, I know you won't shun danger, but do, I beseech you, avoid discomfort like the plague. And of all the advice I had joining the army, it was the best I ever got. Very difficult to follow, but still. And then the university said that what they wanted me to do, the university, they set up a, I suppose the OTC of the university, set up a sort of liaison thing. And they said, well, you want to join up, the thing to do, you have got the certificate A, I think you should join an army unit, you can go and see them in London at a certain place, and you'll probably be sent for cadet training, which is what I did.
Now, who did you join in London?
I was called the Westminster Rifles, and it was a TA unit.
So that'd be the London Regiment?
Yes. Yes.
Do you know which battalion that is? We can look it up, I suppose.
I only went to their headquarters, actually, where I had a medical examination and was passed fit. Well, I was damn fit in those days. And then I was told to go home.
And when was that?
That must have been end of September or beginning of October 39. End of September, I think.
So that was just a formal recruitment, but they didn't take you in to
no,
train.
I didn't. I wasn't given a uniform or anything. I was given a day's pay, and I signed the, you know, I kissed the book. So I did enlist. And then the next thing was, I was told to report to the cadet training unit at Sandhurst.
Now, what was the setup at Sandhurst when you joined? You joined them presumably at October then?
Yes. Well, the regular army recruits hadn't finished yet. They still had one term to go, so we began by being the first company of cadets, following the last company of gentlemen cadets, which amused me rather.
What was your status as, you know, I mean, there is that difference between cadets and gentlemen cadets. No. What was, I mean, was that how they looked on you?
Absolutely no difference whatsoever, except that we were going to be, if we passed out, we were going to be wartime commissioned officers, and they, if they, when they passed out, would become regular army officers. That was the only difference.
They didn't treat you in a different way?
No, not at all.
What were your fellow cadets like? I mean, what were their origins like?
All sorts. I mean, there were lots of people like me. I think everybody had, most people did have Certificate A from an OTC somewhere or another. But some were, some were people who, well, there's one chap in my bunch who was a New Zealander who happened to be in this country back on leave, and he joined up instead of going back to New Zealand. He'd been a sheep farmer in New Zealand. He was older than the rest of us.
But it would be fair to say that most of the cadets were of privileged background, not excessively privileged, but certainly not just from anywhere.
I think that's true. It's true to say that at that time, yes. Because they were mostly people who'd been at a boarding school, a public school, and had got this OTC thing by him. So they'd done some elementary basics, if you like.